I got Larry put down on the program, and so I felt the need to explain that to you guys. But been explaining that my whole life. You know, your name's Will Williford. Yeah, it's a long story. But I'm grateful to be here, man. I'm grateful to the God I believe in for allowing me the opportunity to be here, and I'm really grateful for you guys for sharing this day with me, because I know that without a higher power and without you guys in my life, I have no shot at getting sober, staying sober, so thank you. And I have to thank the committee, man. The energy here is great, man. It's so awesome to come to the Midwest and just see the spirit of Cookie Anonymous alive and well. So I get a cold call from Mike, I don't know, 6 months ago. He's like, hey, you have a tape you could send in? We might want you to come speak. And I found somebody that had something recorded, and he like emailed it on my phone. I sent it to him. He couldn't get it to work, but I guess somehow it worked. And Mike said, yeah, we want you to come. And, you know, he's just been awesome, man. I let him know when I was arriving, and he picked me up at the airport and brought me here, and my room wasn't ready. He took me in his room, and yeah, I mean, that's just what we do, man. Come on, I'm away from my wife. I get lonely. For the record, I was the little spoon. Don't we all like to be held? Right. All right, you guys are my people. I like this. So yeah, man, I was supposed to, somewhere in the beginning of the book, it says, followed in the back are 42 stories of people that share in their own point of view and in their own words how they developed a relationship with God, and that's what I'm going to try to do for you tonight. And it also asks that, whenever we hear someone tell their story, we ask ourselves, I got high like that, or I drank like that, or I felt like that, or most importantly, I think this could work for me too. So I invite you to do that. To the people that have been here before me, I appreciate you guys for keeping the doors open and showing me how this thing works. And for all you new guys, man, welcome. Welcome to the coolest thing I've really ever done in my life. My mom was a hippie. My dad was a Vietnam War vet. It's like straight out of Forrest Gump. But and my father had a little problem with heroin. My mom had a little thing going on with speed. And somewhere in the middle, I came out. And I was very well crafted for Cookie Anonymous. I grew up in an addict household, man. I knew what addiction looked like, and I knew the effects of it long before I even knew what drugs were. I knew about abuse and violence and chaos and insanity and just all the wonderful things that come along with addiction. I lived it, that doesn't make me an addict, but I knew what it was about. And I knew about fear at a very young age. And really, I had every reason in the world to not be what I saw. I mean, I had great anti-role models, I knew what not to be. I knew what not to become, but I now know that this isn't something that I decide for myself or that I choose. I'm an addict. No matter how smart I am or how educated I get, I'm an addict, and it has nothing to do with what I know or don't know. But my mom kind of snuck out in the middle of the night with me and my little sister and moved back to, we're like right on the border of Philadelphia and Bucks County. So we're like not quite Philly, not quite suburbs, like somewhere in the middle. And I grew up in my grandparents' house, man. And like really, once I got there, like things were good. Dinner was on the table. My grandparents would sit and do homework with me and listen to me read. And morals and values were instilled in my life. And I was taught right from wrong. And I was shown good from bad. And for whatever reason, man, I just gravitated toward the negative. Always. I love chaos. 9 years sober, 12 steps in my life a few times. I still love chaos. I will go out of my way to watch a fight. I mean, it's just the way I am. I mean, I don't know if that has anything to do with me being an addict, but I'm certainly attracted to chaos. And my mom, she found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was about 7 or 8, and she stayed sober, man. And And anytime I attend an AA meeting, I thank them for bringing home my mother, because I really don't know what my life would look like if it wasn't for that, you know. And but like, yeah, totally. And so I got this mom who's like sober, going to meetings, always had two jobs or a job and going to school to get a better job. And she was really like just grinding to do what she needed to do to raise her kids. And she had nothing I wanted to aspire to be, man. It didn't attract me. You know, my dad, who was like the war vet, biker, collect call from prison dad, drug dealer, like he was my hero. Did nothing to raise us, but he was my hero, you know? And that's just the way it was, man. I just always had like the wrong role models. And then, like, when I was old enough to hang out in the neighborhood, like, that's where I learned how to grow up. You know, the kids that stay after school and do whatever it is that those kids end up doing, like, they didn't really have anything I wanted or aspired to be, and the kids I hung out with had better things to do. And so that's what I did, you know, and I'm certainly a product of my neighborhood. Like, I heard a guy speak one time, and I always loved quoting it. He said, "I wasn't raised in a dysfunctional family, I was raised in a dysfunctional neighborhood." I'm like, yeah, I can identify with that. Like, I learned how to grow up at the park. Like, that's where we grew up. You know, like, that's where I learned how to become the man that I was trying to be. And so, I don't know, like, we'll fast forward all the way to when I was 13. that's a long time to be restless and irritable. But I went down the shore to my cousin's house. We met some chick. She was like, "You want to sneak out tonight?" I said, "Yes." We snuck out. She said, "You want a drink?" I said, "Absolutely." We didn't know where we were going to get alcohol, so I broke in someone's house. I stole a couple wine coolers, whatever they had in the fridge while the people were sleeping. And me, my cousin, and this girl drank all four pina colada wine coolers. So I was pretty gangster from the start. You know, I didn't feel any effects from it. Like, nothing happened. No magic. But I felt cool, you know, like wow, it was crazy, man. Like, you just dare him to do crazy stuff. He just does it. And I like that. Like, I like that attention. I don't know that I'm craving for attention. I don't know that I'm suffering from this illness inside me that just wants me to be separate from the rest of you people. I don't know any of that stuff. I'm 13. I just know I like to get attention. So I do crazy stuff. I do a lot of crazy stuff. And I have fun. I mean, I really did. No regrets. Had some good times. And so the following weekend, now that I drink, I'm on the drinking team. You know, I go down to the keg party in the woods, because that's how we did it. We had kegs in the woods. I don't know how you guys do it out here. But so I go and I start drinking, man. And I get drunk, you know, and the magic happened, man. Oh, did the magic happen. You know, like, I fit in, man. I fit in. I connected. I never knew how disconnected I was from the world and the people around me until I got drunk and felt that connection. Never knew how separate I was until I felt that connection, man. I felt it the moment I got drunk. I mean, when I got drunk, man, I didn't worry about anything except the present moment and being where I was with who I was. And I never felt that before in my life. You know, I didn't worry about if I was cool like I knew I was. And I didn't worry about if I was tough like I knew I was. I didn't worry about if I was a pimp like I knew I was. Like, all, you know, I just got tougher and cooler and slicker, like, all with a few drinks, you know? And, man, how amazing that was. And that was the first and last time I drank socially. I solely drank to get that effect from that point forward. And so I get really drunk. Now, when you have a ex-meth head alcoholic mom who's sober in AA, you really can't get away with much. But you know, I tried. So I come home, I get caught instantly, and she doesn't want to talk to me, so the next morning we have that talk. You know, and she said, "You know, well, I'm an alcoholic, your dad's an alcoholic, it's not looking too good for you, you know. I'm sorry, but that's just the way it goes." And she said some stuff, man, and like, it was very informative and it was very truthful. But what I heard, and she said, "Well, like, I know that I can't stop anything from happening that's going to happen in your life, you know, but I hope that you can at least proceed with caution. I hope that you can at least be mindful of the fact that you are very susceptible to being an alcoholic." And I knew this day would come. Like, I knew one day you would come home drunk. I knew it. You know, like, I'm not blind to that option. But I really thought it would happen when you were, like, 16, not 13. And then I heard it. I heard the only thing I needed to hear that morning, that I could drink when I'm 16. And, I mean, that's what I heard. And so then I just go on, man, and high school was awesome. I didn't like buying drugs, so I sold them. So I had an uncle that helped me in my weed business, so that was cool. So it's always good to have a mentor. So, you know, I just take a couple ounces off his pound and work my way up. But it's so much cheaper that way, you know? So that's what I do. I think I'm like this neighborhood drug dealer. I guess I was, but, you know, I'm just selling weed like all suburb kids do, where I'm from anyway. But, and then by the time I was 16, I guess maybe I was 14, 15, my father got out of prison. He did 6 or 8 years for actually smuggling pot from New Mexico. I don't need to tell his story. It was a misunderstanding, I'm sure. But so he was a collect call dad most of my life. And then when I was 14, he got out, and I thought, all right, cool. Like 14-year-old boy, I'm gonna get my dad. You know, my tough, mean dad, like my awesome dad. And he was diagnosed with liver disease, direct related to his drinking and drugging. We went out to see him, me and my sister, and then he came out to see us the following Christmas. And we did that for 2 years. So when I was 16, he came out for Christmas, and he got really sick. We put him in the hospital, and he ended up dying there on a visit to see us. And that sucks, man, when you're 16. Like, it sucks. And I didn't really know him. But as an aspiring drug addict that I was, it gave me a really good excuse to just not care about anything anymore. I'm done. Over it. You know, and I always wore my best FU face on it, and like, you had to know how much I didn't care about you or me or anything going on. Like, I just had to let you know how much rebellion I have in me, you know. And then because he was in the service, I actually got offered a college scholarship. The VA would pay for it, which really wasn't something that we talked about where I was hanging out, but I'll take a freebie, you know, so... So I take the SATs. I don't know why. I'm not that smart, but I test really good. I don't know how that is, but just because I'm a con artist. But so I do pretty good on the SATs. I trick them somehow, and a couple schools actually were willing to accept me. And then I go visit my friend, my cousin, who goes to Penn State, and my mom drops me off, and she drops me off. He pulls out like a 4-foot bong, and he's like, "This is college, man." I'm like, "Sweet," And I chose my school, you know, like we went to a couple parties that night and college was decided. I'm going to Penn State. Like, why wouldn't I? Most major life decisions I make are based on whichever one seems more fun or whichever one's easier. I mean, major life decisions always, you know, which one's more fun. So I choose college. I go. And when I got up there, man, it was pretty nice, man. Like a lot of those kids, their parents have money and give it to their kids. And the kids are so generous up there, and, you know, there was a party every time of the day, every day of the week, and I mean, whew, man, I just thought I was in heaven. You know, the kids up there just drank and drugged a lot differently than we did. I mean, when you had good stuff, like, you hid. You know, you do the eyeballs to the one guy, you let him know, you dip off, you know, you do your drugs, and like, up there, it's like, oh, here, free for everyone. Like, everybody, do our drugs. Like, this is great. So I would help myself to whatever they were offering and then take whatever they weren't, you know? because I was just like this punk, man. I had this punk attitude because I was less fortunate that, like, it was my duty to steal from these kids that had affluent parents. Like, it's my responsibility to take from the rich and give to myself, you know? And I didn't see anything wrong with that, you know? And by this time, I'm starting to notice some differences, you know, like, I'm starting to think maybe I don't drink like everybody else does, because I drank like everybody in my neighborhood, you know, like, I didn't stand out in the crowd at home, but when I went to school, like, I definitely stood out in the crowd, you know, like, because those kids were, like, you know, worried about, like, the importance of their, you know, college education and their future, and I was just not into that stuff, so Penn State's got, I don't know, 50,000 kids, 100,000 on a football weekend. And I'm still that guy. I get the public drunkenness. You know, I get the disorderly. I get the, you know, naked where you're not supposed to be. You know, just trying to have fun. So I quickly start getting in trouble up there. And I would get in trouble back home, too. So I got put on probation in two different counties. I tricked both of them into believing that the other one was monitoring me. It was the ultimate move. And but because part of the probation up at school, I had to do this drug and alcohol class. I was like 19, 20. And I go to my first drug and alcohol class. It's Monday night. And high as a kite. And we're going to do random drug tests tonight. I'm like, what? Like, nobody said anything about that. That's really rude and invasive. And I said the first prayer I ever said in my life. I was like, God, please, like, I'll be good. Like, I'll be good from here on out, man. Like, please don't let my name get called. And anytime I prayed my way out of a fuck, my name actually didn't get called. It was a miracle. And anytime I pray my way out of a foxhole, I quickly don't hold my end of the bargain. So, because I'm out now, you know. Coast is clear. Shh, that was close, you know. And let's get high. So that goes on for another couple months. I turned 21. I came home for the weekend, normal weekend. Got drunk at the bar. Came to in a crack house. You know, same old stuff. And I go back to school Sunday night or Monday. Go to the drug and alcohol class again. And they announced they're going to do random drug tests again. So I didn't have the balls to try to pray out of that one. I just felt embarrassed. So I'm like, all right, it's probably gonna go down. And sure as heck, my name got called. And so I failed for a few things. And my probation officer, she says, all right, what do you think we should do here? I said, I think I need help. She was like, all right, you wait right here. I'm gonna get you some help. I said, okay. And she got another probation officer, and he said, all right. He walks in. He said, all right, put your face against the wall, hands behind your back. Let's go. Yeah, come on, man. And so the drug and alcohol class was at the courthouse, which was like right up to like 100 yards from the jail. So, I mean, within an hour, I'm like in an orange jumpsuit on the block, freaked out. Like, I'm too pretty. I'm too suburb. Like, I can't be here. This is crazy, you know. And turns out it's a bunch of loudmouth punk kids that eat candy and slap cards and, you know, I could do that kind of stuff. So I did okay in county jail. But I got to do the collect call to mom, man. It was right before Thanksgiving. You know, I was supposed to come home for Thanksgiving. And I got to do the collect call to mom and tell her I'm not going to be there. The call did all the work for me. You know, this is, will you accept the call from Will from Center County Correctional Facility? Plus one to accept the charge. So, like, I didn't have to tell her anything. By the time we're on the phone, she knows the deal. So that's a good icebreaker. And then and so I let her know I'm not going to be home for Thanksgiving, you know, and I'm upset, and I could tell she's upset, but I'm okay. Like, you know, I'm just, I'm jailing, so I'm all right. Christmas comes by, so I end up doing, like, whatever, 90 days or something, nothing crazy. But Christmas comes, she drives 3 hours to come see me, put her hand on glass, wish me Merry Christmas, And, like, I think that's cool. Like, I'm earning my street cred, you know, I'm, like, gangster, you know, just me doing my county jail. And then New Year's Eve comes, and I see on the TV Times Square. And everybody's partying, having a good time, and I'm devastated. Like, I'm crushed that I'm missing the party. I don't care that my mom had to explain to everybody at Thanksgiving that I'm in jail and I won't be home for the holidays. I don't care that she had to drive 3 hours to come see me for Christmas. I don't care about any of that stuff. I just care I'm missing a party on New Year's Eve, you know, because that's how selfish I get, you know. And so you meet the kids in county jail who have been in there a lot, and so they're like, yo, man, if you want to get out in your 90, you should go to AA. Looks good for parole. I said, all right, cool, I'm in. And so I go to AA. I go to my first meeting. Now, I kind of was in meetings prior because my mom got sober when I was pretty young, so sometimes she had to take us to meetings. So, I mean, I knew what you guys were. I didn't know anything about it. And so I go to my first actual AA meeting in jail. And what I saw, which is typically not the truth because I perceive everything wrong, but what I saw is this miserable old guy, arms folded, sitting at the end of the table looking down at us like, you know, if you want what we have, you'll do what we do. And I'm like, I don't even want what this guy has. Like, why would I possibly do what he's doing? And but I go, you know, and I sing the song. I walk the walk. I fake the fake. And I get out in 90 days. And then what I would do is, I would never say sober, but maybe like sober would be like drinking occasionally, smoking weed. Like that was sober to me. You know, like, come on. Like, weed. Like, really? You know? So I would get high. I would go to a meeting. I'd be like, oh, man, this is really cool. So I would, like, pretend to go to AA. I'd reinstate in school. I'd fail another drug test because I always failed them. And go back to jail, flunk out of school again, try it again next semester, do it again. After three semesters, I said, you know what? College probably isn't for me. I just couldn't make a semester without going to jail. You know, it was just getting a little crazy. So I did with what all heroes do. I moved back in with Mom, and I pursue my drug dealing career because I don't really like working that much. And I think I'm like this kingpin drug dealer, and all my friends are kingpin drug dealers. And all we really did was like move a lot of weight to each other and like flip for that. And like, you know, I'll give you this, you give me that. But like, we weren't kingpins, but we thought we were. And like, I don't care that my mom's probably 10 years sober at the time, finally has a husband that doesn't beat her up, finally has a good home to live in. Like, I don't care about any of that. Like, I just brought the insanity of addiction right back into her life with full force, you know? And I don't even think twice about it. You know, I don't care. And she's, like, telling me, like, my husband's going to leave me because you're crazy. And like, she's like, I can't pick him over you. You know, like, you're going to ruin my life again. And like, it sucks. But, like, I don't know how to change that. Frothy emotional appeal don't work for me. You know, as much as I would love to stop and not hurt my mother, I can't stop for that. That's not a good enough reason. It's not a powerful enough reason for me to just stop. I have to keep doing it. I have to do it in a different way. And it just got ugly, man. It got ugly. And finally, it was one of those up for a couple of days or weeks or whatever. And my mom always knew. I told you about her. She always knew. She'd be like, you're still up from Tuesday, aren't you? And yeah, you know, and I find out it's Mother's Day. Ah, that was nice of you. Thank you. I find out it's Mother's Day because, you know, when you're up for a week, it's hard to keep track of the days. So it's Mother's Day. I go to 7-Eleven. I buy some flowers or stole them. I don't know. But I bring them home to my mom and Happy Mother's Day, Mom, I love you. And she just starts crying, and she said, well, this is the worst Mother's Day of my life. It's killing me to see you like this. It's killing me to see you live your life like this. And once again, like it's tugging on my heart bad, man, but like I don't know what to do in that kind of situation. Like the only thing I can do is just bounce and keep getting high. And so that's what I did. And then eventually what happened was my mom stopped going to AA for a little bit and started going to Al-Anon. And did they ruin everything? They taught her stuff like boundaries and, you know, healthy stuff. And it was only a couple months went by, and it was right after my 25th birthday. She just said, well, you know what? I can't watch you kill yourself in my house any longer, and you need to leave. And I know that this might be your death certificate, but it might be your chance to get sober. But either way, it's not happening in my house. You have to figure it out on your own. And that's got to be tough to throw your kid out. And I don't think about that. I'm just like, what? You know, what are you talking about? Like, how can you do this to me? You know? And I hit the streets. I'm not like a real homeless guy. I'm like, hey, bro, let me stay on your couch for a little bit until I can find somebody else to let me sleep on their couch kind of thing. You know, once in a while I'll stay in my car just because the commute to North Philly was long and, you know, it's just easier to stay down there sometimes. But I'm homeless and it's not ugly. I mean, it's not pretty. It's pretty ugly. By this point, I got a full speedball habit in my arm and it's bad, you know. I wore dirty work clothes even though I didn't work. I was filthy. When I got sober, I weighed 152 pounds and just filthy. I mean, I didn't shower. I didn't eat. I didn't do anything that you're supposed to do as a human being. I just lived to get loaded, and that was it, man. And And what happened was every once in a while, I would still go try to drink like my friends that were successful. Countless vain attempts to prove I could drink like other people. So every once in a while, I would go to the bar and see my old high school friends, and I would get drunk with them, and then I would go to a crack house every time. Every time. Like, damn it. Like, what happened, man? Like, we were just the Chickie and Pete's. Like, why are we in a crack house again? Because I just don't know how to do that. I don't know how to just get drunk and go home, you know? I get drunk and smoke crack. And so I stop at a friend's house on the way to another friend's house. She saw the shape I was in. She calls 911. I was met by police, paramedics, a couple friends. They called mom. It turned into an intervention. Not the cool intervention on TV. I don't think the show was out yet. So I'm not famous. I'm a little upset about it. I didn't get to go to like West Palm or anywhere cool like that. But I was faced with the truth, man. I was cornered and I couldn't duck it. I mean, everybody was there, concerned for me, concerned for my life, upset, and I didn't get it. Like why do you guys care so much about the life I'm living? Like, I'm not affecting any of you people. Let me do what I'm doing. And it was just the biggest lie I always told myself was that I wasn't hurting anyone else, you know, because I was a tornado, man. I left a trail of innocent victims everywhere I went. Everywhere I went, I left a trail of innocent victims. And my mom said, well, if you want to get help, you can come home tonight. And I said, okay. No great moment, no big aha, no moment of clarity. It was just like, I was just out of hustle. I was just out of gas. I just didn't feel like running. I was just like, all right, fine. You know, and I go back to my mom's. It's like Christmas Eve, maybe Christmas Eve Eve. And I can't get in anywhere. So I bunker down at mom's and start sweating it out. Christmas morning comes, and my sister's there, and some family members show up, and they're like all doing Christmas morning like a happy little family, and I'm sweating out a heroin habit on the couch, like, no big deal, you know? Like, no, go on, enjoy your Christmas, don't mind me. and like, I don't see anything wrong with that. Like, and they're just like trying to pretend like that's not going on, you know? And God, it's like so insane. You know, my poor family. And so the next day I tried to get in somewhere, but I didn't have a photo ID because that's like really the last thing I carry when I'm living the life I live. So I have to go to the DOT. I get an ID. My license was suspended for 10 years, so I couldn't get a license. So I tried to go get an ID, and I get one. And December 27th, 2006, I checked into a detox. And it was the last day I found it necessary to put something in my body to feel normal. I had a pair of sweatpants, two hoodies, and a pillow and blanket that my mom gave me, and I checked into rehab, detox. First day in detox, I met a beautiful crackhead stripper. She was hot, and so we were in love. So we started, you know, pursuing our new relationship, and she it's true. She helped me through detox, which was nice. After, I guess, 4 days of detox, I transfer over to the rehab side. And then I met Amanda, and Amanda had 20 days sober at the time, so she kind of had something to offer. You know, she's a little more stability in her life. She knew where the ping pong table was in the basement of the rehab, so. So I cheat on my detox girlfriend with my rehab girlfriend. I'm a drug addict, man. But like, if I don't have drugs, like, I gotta treat the sobriety with something, you know. And I treated sobriety with drugs most of my life. But if I don't have drugs to treat it with, I'll treat it with a woman, you know. I'll treat it with a tattoo, shopping, spending, tripping, not acid, like a vacation. You know, I'll just do stuff to get me out of me. I don't, like, I swore that I had a heroin problem. That's the only thing I need to be here for. You know, all the other stuff will just work itself out, you know. But what I learned was I had a sober problem, and it was bad. You know, I had a really bad sober problem. I just can't stand life sober. It's just awful. It's been the biggest trigger in my life. Like, if I wake up sober, it's like a huge trigger to get high, man. It's just awful. And so I suffer from this, like, sober condition, man. It's just awful. And so, fortunately, I was able to treat it with some women in rehab. And that helped for a period of time, you know? And then I get into a fight with the nurse because she didn't have me on the correct med program that I was supposed to be on, because clearly I know more than that. And what does a nurse who went to med school that works in rehab know? So anytime I don't get my way, I handle it like about a six-year-old. I stomp my feet, I yell and scream and make a scene, and because I'm not getting my way. So that's what I do, right in front of the nurse. And she said, you know, you should probably go talk to your counselor. I said, you know what, that's a good idea. Like, screw you, you know. So storm up to my counselor. What kind of place is this? You know, I'm trying to get sober. Nobody understands what I'm trying to do. And you're trying to keep me on Depakote to detox from Xanax, but I already have a low blood pressure. Like, I'm just freaking out. And she was like, whoa, Will, like, you're still in the driver's seat, huh? I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? She's like, you still think you got this? I'm like, you're damn right I got this. She was like, you're in rehab. And it was just so profound. I mean, I was like, wow, you're right. And like that was the moment, man. Look, I've been unemployable most of my life. I've been homeless. I've been without family. I've been without money. I've been without everything at one point or another. And I can do those things rather comfortably. But what I always had was the idea that I still know what's best for me, no matter what. No matter how educated you are, how experienced you are, you can't tell me about me better than I can. You don't know. I mean, I was just arrogant, and I was a punk, and just completely unwilling to listen to anybody talk about me to me. And it broke. Like, at that point, at that moment, man, it just broke. Like, I realized, like, I don't know what's best for me anymore. Like, I can't run my own life, you know? And maybe somebody else knows better than I do. And like, that was the moment. That was the big moment. It happened, you know. And I stopped from trying to be the cool kid in rehab to like actually trying to listen, you know. And I get out. I move into a halfway house where I was in a little basement bedroom with three sets of bunk beds, and four of us slept in there, and the other bunk bed was our closet. And that's where I got sober, man. I had a curfew and I had a chore, and I'm treated like a little kid, you know. Because that's what I was. You know, I didn't know how to adult. Sometimes I still don't. But and I just listened to people that were sober tell me how to get sober, man. And I found the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. They brought a meeting into the rehab. I met a couple people. And when I got out, one of the kids at the halfway house, because you can't leave without a senior member. So he was like, listen, man, whatever meeting you want to go to tonight, I'll go with you. You know, and I'm like, awesome, man. I want to go to CA. He's like, all right, cool. And I had a phone list that I got when I was in rehab, and I called a kid, and I was like, hey, man, I was in treatment, and I met you. I don't know if you remember me, man, but I live in this halfway house on State Road, and I was wondering if you could come pick me up for the meeting tonight, and he said, absolutely. And I said, well, I can't go unless I bring somebody else from the house. Can you bring him, too? He said, of course. And you guys just picked me up and drug me to CA, man, and I never left, you know, and sometimes I go to outside meetings for my alcohol problems, but, you know, I'm a CA guy. I love CA. I never left, and I hope to never leave. Yeah. And so I get there, man, and I'm, like, I'm all fired up. I'm ready to get sober, man. 30 days. Woo, let's do this, you know? And I said, all right, man, get a home group. I'm like, cool. I got three, you know? I said, get a commitment. I said, all right, I'll do coffee. That's all you'll let me do. So I did coffee. Never drank coffee. Didn't know anything about coffee. I'm more of a shoot cocaine, smoke crack kind of guy, you know. Coffee doesn't have what I'm looking for, you know. But I'll make it. Yeah, sure. Like, sign me up. So I get my first coffee commitment. I don't put a filter in the coffee machine. So obviously everybody knows what happens when you do that. I didn't. So I learned real quick that I don't know how to make coffee. And so what I had to do is, like, I had to show up the next week. I had to show up a little earlier, introduce myself to the people that were there, and say, hey, my name's Will. I have the coffee commitment. I don't really know how to make a pot of coffee. Could you show me? And I asked for some experience, strength, and hope, where I had none. You know, and I had been doing that my whole life. Like when I only knew how to like split a Philly and didn't know how to peel a Dutch, like I asked somebody to show me and they showed me. When I didn't know how to turn 3 ounces of Coke into four, I asked somebody to show me and they showed me. When I didn't know how to cook crack, I asked somebody to show me and they showed me. Like when 8th and Indy was dry, like they told me to go down to Somerset. Like I'm always willing to ask for direction when I'm out there. Like show me how to do what it is I need to do. And then, you know, I have to have that same attitude when I get sober, man. But what the problem is, my ego shows up, and I'm better, right? And God forbid I ask for help, or ask for some direction, or ask somebody to show me how to make a pot of coffee. You know, what are they going to think of me now? And so, like, the fight begins, where the ego starts growing, but I'm still craving to get better, you know? And they told me to get a sponsor, and I got a sponsor. And, you know, and he sat me down, and he offered me what he had, and it worked. You know, and I got a little better, and I got through these steps, and I did a four-step, and I made some amends, and I felt a little better. And we didn't really do it out of the book. We were kind of like working the spiritual principles behind the steps, and whatever. It was working for him at the time, and it worked for me at the time. I got about a year sober, year and a half sober, and then I want to get better. I want to get more. You know, like I like this. And I'm starting to see the people that are like really sober, like them super sober-ass dudes, like... You know the guys, man, like they're quoting stuff and they're just sounding, yeah. I'm like, yeah, that's what I need. I need to be like that guy. You know, I want that kind of sober. And I find this guy, man, he had a far worse story than me. He was sober probably 10, 11 years at the time. And I knew the book incredibly. And I heard him speak and this dude was a gangster. Like, shootouts out front of his mom's house, like gangster. And I'm like, yeah, this is my guy. He's going to keep me humble. And so I'm like, what could I possibly say? Like, I can't impress this guy. You know, he's been like shot four times. Like, yeah, what am I going to tell you about? So I just asked him for help, man. And he said, sure, man. He invited me into his house. All right, third time's a charm. He invited me into his house, sat me on his couch, and he opened up the big book to me and exposed me to the program, outline of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that I had never been exposed to it prior, you know? And I was just set on fire, man. I was set on fire, you know? It was amazing. You know, I just had this awesome new tool of recovery and this awesome new language that I spoke and just this awesome new mission, you know? But the problem with the arrogant, egotistical, cocky bastard such as myself is that when I have that information, I have those tools, and I have that new way of life, I get better then, like almost immediately. Like I get on these like spiritual hilltops real quick where like it's a beautiful scene, but it's like lonely, you know? And then I just start attacking everybody because they're not doing it right. Like, they're just not doing it right. Oh my God, who is sponsoring you? Like, just who is a home group member here? Like, what is going on? Like, oh, did I have opinions? Oh man, did I have opinions? And I don't know if anybody goes through that around the 2 year stage. You know everything? I did. So, but I'm big booking it up, man, and I'm shoving it down anybody's throat that'll let me. Probably had a backpack full of four steps just waiting. You know, just come on, man, let's do this. You know, I'll have you write a four step in an hour. Let's go. Just so arrogant. and what happened was at some point I made this switch from using that book as a tool of recovery and started using it as a weapon to just assassinate everybody that wasn't doing it right, everybody that wasn't doing it like I learned in the book, everybody that I thought, you know, wasn't big book oriented like they should be, or solution based like they should be, and I just got cocky, and then but I don't know it because I'm the last person to find out this stuff, and then I just start declining. Like I was so caught up in the words of the book that I lost the message. Like I just knew the words. I could recite every page. So what? Like I didn't know what I was saying. I just had a box cake, and I could read to you the recipe for the box cake, but I couldn't bake the cake anymore. I could just read you the recipe to make a box cake. Like, I could read the words in the book, and I could tell you what's on page 30, and I could tell you what's this principle, and I could tell you all this stuff, but I don't know the message anymore. I just remember all this stuff because I'm so damn smart, and you guys need to know about it, and just so cocky, man. And then I just get blocked off from God, man. Ego's in full effect, man. I'm blocked off from God. And I'm blocked off from God, it's me again. And when it's me again, it's a problem, you know, and it's just a problem. And so I'm judging like crazy. I'm playing on my phone all meetings because, like, I'm just not comfortable where I'm at, you know. Like, so I got to be, like, working on something else. And, like, in conversations, I would spend talking about other people because, like, I'm not comfortable with where I'm at. So, like, let's talk about them, you know. Let's talk about what they're doing wrong. Did you hear who's doing what? Like, who's doing steroids? Who's getting high again? Who's sleeping with who? Like, you know, I just want to know. You know, I just want to be in the in crowd. I just want to gossip a little bit. You know, no harm. And so it gets bad. And then I become the person I'm gossiping about. You know, I become the person that's just not acting right in meetings. I'm sleeping with girls that I shouldn't be sleeping with. And, like, just really messing with God's children in a way that I shouldn't be. And just... character assassinating anybody that I can, and like it goes on like that for like a little while, where I got sponsees that are breaking up with me because they're tired of sticking up for me, you know. I friends that just are sick of defending me, sick of like saying they're my friend because of the way I act in meetings, outside of meetings, and just in CA as a whole, really in any fellowship that will let me. And then I had this girlfriend who wasn't in the program, which was great for a creep like me, because then I could still be single in CA, but have this girlfriend on the side, and I just drug her through hell, man. I just really did, you know, poor girl. And finally, you know, I get caught cheating, and again, and I just, like, I tell her, you know, like, you're probably better off, like, without me, because, like, I'm not doing you any good by being with you, and so, like, I tell her to roll, and my sponsor started a company, got real successful, offered me a job, and so I'm working for him, and he's kind of not my sponsor anymore. He's kind of like my friend and my boss and my vacation buddy, and then I gossip about him, you know, because I just gossip about everybody, and then he tells me something, I run back to the person, like, just all the insanity, and he was, like, he was pissed. He couldn't believe I did that, you know, And then, like, within an instant, I lost my sponsor by name, my friend, and my job, you know. And so there I was. I was maybe 5.5, 6 years sober, and I just lost this whole pretty little life that I built for myself here in CA. Like, all of it. Lost the job, lost the friends, lost the girl, lost everything. And I'm just stuck with me and my arrogance and my big book knowledge. And then it just got lonely, man. And then, like, my head was just on me. Like, I just talking to me. Like, just, I mean, it couldn't wait for me to wake up in the morning to just beat on me. And, like, would just keep me up at night just talking to me, just telling me what a piece of crap I am, and just telling me I'm no good. And, I mean, I just couldn't shake it, man. I couldn't get 5 minutes of silence to myself. I couldn't get it. It was just insanity in my brain. And finally, the thought said, man, if you just go get high, this will go away. This will go away. You'll get 5 minutes of peace, and it'll probably be worth it. It'll explain to everybody why you're acting the way you're acting in here anyway, because you're about to go on a run. You know, and it was the only relief I could think of to get, was to get loaded. And I knew that's not what I wanted to do, but it was the only thing I could really, like, physically wrap my head around to make my brain shut up for just a minute. And the thought really scared me. Because I knew I didn't want to get high, but it seemed like an actual option at that point. And so I knew I needed help, man. So I go to a meeting I don't normally go to, because nobody at the meetings I go to could possibly help me, because I know better than all of them. Because I just couldn't be helped, man. So I go to this other meeting, and this guy he came down from Queens, and he spoke, and he's like, man, it's great to be back here, and I really don't remember the faces, and I don't even remember the place that well, but I tell you what, when spirit connects with spirit, man, something's really shared and remembered. And I was just sitting there like, what the hell kind of spiritual is this dude on? You know, like, wow, like, people are really that spiritual? And I don't even remember what he said the rest of the meeting. But I turned to my one friend that I had left, and I said, man, he did pretty good. And he was like, yeah, he killed it. I was like, I think I'm going to go talk to him. He's like, you probably should. he had my back, you know? So I go up to him, you know, like I'm slick. Like, hey, bro, like I go to New York a lot, man. Maybe I could get your number and we could hit a meeting up there or something. And he was like, yeah, sure, call me anytime. So I get his number, and then I prepare my will you go out with me speech, you know? I'm 6 years sober. I got a pretty good knowledge of the book. I think I just need to go through steps again. I'm already telling him how he's going to help me, you know? and so I call, and I'm like, look, man, you know, I'm not doing too good. I could use some help. And he said, well, when I met you last night, I could tell you were hurting, you know, and I can tell that you're blocked off, you know? And I'm not sure how I can help you. You live in Philly, and I live in New York. But I'll tell you what, I'm going to pray on it. I'm going to meditate with it for a little bit, and I want you to give me a call later tonight, and I'll let you know what I came up with. And I hung up, and I'm like, who actually prays and meditates on decisions? like, when I'm sick, man, I don't hang around those kind of people. Like, you don't want to be the sicko hanging around all these, like, spiritual people, you know? Like, you can't be that guy, you know? Like, it's painful. So, like, I hang around people that are, like, you know, kind of doing the same kind of things I'm doing, you know? And like, you know, they all have like 6 months and they're like, oh, this is awesome. And like, yeah, we could like still talk shit on everybody and like sleep with girls. And I'm like, yeah, it's great. You know, like, so I call him later that night, man. And he said, look, I'm going to help you, but I don't want to waste my time. You know, like I work with a lot of guys and I do a lot of stuff for the fellowship and I don't want to waste my time. So like if you're not going to do what I'm asking you to do, then let's just, you know, let's stop here. And I said, no, I'm ready. I need this help. And then we started talking. He's like, so what's going on? You know, and he actually wanted to talk. And like, I wasn't like really ready to like get into all that right now. And I'm like, well, you know, old behaviors are showing up. He's like, old behaviors? It's like, if you're still doing them, they're not very old. Fair enough. I said, you know, I'm just acting out. And he's like, acting out how? I'm like, yeah, spending money I shouldn't, and sleeping with girls I shouldn't. He said, new girls? I said, sometimes. He said, did the fellowship save your life? I said, absolutely. He said, then why don't you let it save theirs and leave them the hell alone? Nobody really talked to me like that before. I'm like, man, I think I'm going to like and hate this guy a lot. and I just, I got started on this journey all over again, man. I got treated like a new guy. I acted like a new guy. When he said pray, I prayed. We sat on the phone, and he read the big book to me over the phone, and it was painful because I know all the words. And it's hard to just listen to somebody read a book to you that you know all the words to. But I just had to like really use this like set aside prayer and just please like let me forget about all the things I think I know about me and about this program, about this book, and especially you, God, so that I can maybe, just maybe, have a new experience here. And that's what happened, man. And he said, what's your praying like? And I was like, yeah, it's, you know, hit or miss. I said, I'll pray in the car sometimes on the way to work. He said, oh, okay. He said, book talks about an awakening. He said, why don't you, when you open up your eyes, why don't you ask God for some intuitive thought and some strength to carry that out? I said, all right, that's cool. I could try that. So by this point, I had already invited my girlfriend back to live with me because that's what I do. As soon as I think I'm getting better, like I'm already better. So like you come back. Let's make this all work. So she's not in the program. She doesn't like need to rely on a higher power to live her life like a normal human being like I do, right? And so I think it's like embarrassing that I do, right? Like it's, you know, like I don't mind like shooting heroin in front of somebody, but God forbid they see me pray. Like that would be just awkward, you know? So I'm like a ninja. I got a new job pretty quick, and so I'm getting up early, and I'm like slipping out of bed, you know, hitting my knees. All right, God, like help me through the day. You know, please direct my thinking and give me the strength to carry it through. And so I do that for a couple of days, and then like, you know, day 4 or 5, I forget. And so then it's very easy on day 5 or 6 to forget again. And then the third day that I stop praying, I like slip out of bed, and she was like, Will. I'm like, what? She's like, "You're not praying anymore?" I'm like, I didn't realize you knew I was doing that. And she said, "Yeah. I thought you were doing that to be better." And I said, "Yeah, I am." She said, "So why'd you stop?" I said, "Damn." So I'm like, "I don't know." So then I dropped on my knees and I prayed in front of her. And I was really never embarrassed to pray again. I mean, she had a point. Like, God comes to me through all kinds of signals and situations and mostly people. And then I just, I did it all over again, man. I wrote a new four-step, and I took a trip up to Queens and spent the weekend with them and shared my fifth step. And then I just had to go on making all these amends, man. And really, I was the type of scumbag that there really wasn't a meeting I could attend where there wasn't at least a couple amends that I owed there. You know, like, that's just the kind of person I became. And he said, "You leave the new girls alone. Like, don't go making amends to them." And I said, "Okay, fair enough." And so, like, I just, one by one, started knocking off these amends of people in sobriety. I let them know the person I was and how I'm not trying to be that person anymore, and this is what I need to do that. And then he set me up with a surrogate amends for all the new girls, with a woman with, like, 15 years sober. And he first suggested it. Well, he's got this funny way. He doesn't actually suggest. He goes, "Will, do you think you could, you know, do these things?" And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Okay." I'm like, "Ah." I get tricked every time. Like, "Do you think you could find a woman with, like, 10, 15 years sober and make a surrogate amends to her for all the new girls that you used and manipulated?" And I was like, yeah, I could do that. "All right, okay, cool, good." And I'm like, "Wait, did I just sign up for that?" And so I see him, and he's like, "So did you ever find that girl, the woman?" And I said, "No." He said, "All right, cool, I found someone for you." I said, "Oh, thanks, Adrian." So I mean, I talked to this woman, and I let her know what I was trying to do, and she was actually honored that she was asked to participate in what I was trying to do. And I just did the deal and made the amends like I know how to, and I asked for forgiveness and what I could do to make it right. And she said, "Well, God's already forgiven you. Like, when are you going to forgive yourself, you know? And the best way you can help these women is by sharing your experience with people that might be struggling with the same thing." And it went awesome, man. It went really cool. And then I got thrown back into being useful again. You know, people started asking me for help again. And people wanted me to be on committees again. And people wanted me to represent CA in different areas and just do the deal, you know. And I get the sponsoring and I get the service in. And just all kinds of stuff just keeps happening, you know, and stuff keeps getting better. And the fall before that, I decided that I was going to lock in my girlfriend. And so we went on this really cool hike to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and I asked her to marry me. Because if she said no, I'd leave her there. And she said yes, so she got to come home, and we started planning a wedding, and then we got pregnant, and I was on the phone with the bank trying to transfer money to my mom or something, and she said, "Oh, you got pre-approved for a home equity loan." I'm like, "That's amazing. I don't even own a home." And she said, "Well, why don't you find out? I could put you through with the mortgage department. You can find out how to make that happen." And I said, "All right, what the hell?" So, like, I talked to this person. I'm like, "Yeah, I'm really not looking for a mortgage, but you guys just told me that I was pre-approved for a home equity loan. I don't even own a home, so I just figured, what the hell?" And he's like, "All right, well, you need to have, like, this much in the bank. You need to have a credit score of this, and you need to have a debt to income of this." And I'm like, "Yeah, okay. I have all that." He's like, "All right, cool. All you need to do now is apply." I'm like, "Whoa, hold on, man. This is, like, getting really crazy." But I got approved for a mortgage. We looked at a house. We liked it. We bought it. And then we got pregnant. So really, aside from getting married, having a baby, and buying a house, the year's been pretty normal. So we had this beautiful little girl almost 4 months ago, and you know, it's, yeah, cool. And God willing, she'll never have to grow up with what I did. And, all right, I'll keep it together here. Can all you people see me cry? I'm a tough kid from Philly. just amazing stuff's been happening, man. Right after we had the baby, we said, screw it, let's just go get married. Because we had put wedding plans on hold when we got pregnant, and then we just said, screw it, let's just go. So we planned a trip in 5 weeks. We made plans and executed a wedding down in Key Largo. And I called all my friends, and I was like, look, man, don't feel obligated, but we're just going to go. You know, if you want to come, awesome, but if not, no big deal. Like, really, we're just going to go. And, like, all my friends said, yeah, let's go, let's do it. And there's 40 of us down there at a shotgun wedding in Key Largo. That's the kind of people I have in my life today, you know? People that will show up for me, and I know that's only because they feel the same way about me. And then we came home and had a big-ass party, and everybody else got to come, and it was basically like a CA meeting, you know? Mixed in with some family, you know, blood family. But I tell you, like, some really cool things have happened since I've been sober. You know, like, making amends to my mom, who's sober, was incredible. You know, like, just her sitting there and me trying to put into words what I put her through and to try to own up to that and to try somehow, some way to make that right. And she said, Will, I would go through what I went through with you 1,000 times over to just have you the way I have you now. And then my dad, when he died, I didn't go to his funeral. I don't do that kind of stuff. I don't face life. And so I never went to his grave. And then I went to my first or second CA World Convention. I met some hot blonde from LA, of course. And she said, why don't you come to the Palm Springs Convention? I said, yeah, absolutely. And so I decide I'm going to go. And my mom said, you know your dad's buried in Palm Springs? And I was like, wow, that's pretty interesting. You know, so I'm like, maybe I really should go. And so I went, and I got to go see my dad's grave for the first time and make amends to it, you know. And did I need to make amends to my dad at his grave? I don't know, you know, but it felt real, you know. It felt authentic. And I got to share that experience with people that may be struggling with a similar thing. You know, most of the addicts I know have a parent that is one as well, or at least know one that is, and is no longer with us. And what an amazing opportunity. And, like, I had nothing to do with the planning or executing that. Like, when I get out of the way, like, God works out. Every little detail, timing, place, like, just it's just all money. And then when I'm like, hey, let me try to make this work, it is not. It's not smooth. It's not right. It's my will, you know. And God just works out all the details, man, every time I get out of the way. And when I went to the Grand Canyon, I met my little cousins, who I hadn't seen since they were real little. And my little cousin, Megan, she says, Will, if I come to Philly, will you take me snowboarding? I said, yeah, absolutely. And so she came out the following Christmas to go snowboarding. And, well, I mean, she came out with her family, and I took her snowboarding, and I got her lessons because I'm selfish and I want to play on the mountain myself. But I take her, I get her lessons, and she was at the end. She was like, "I'm still not too comfortable." I said, "All right, I'll get you some more lessons. Win-win, you know." And then after that, she was like, "All right, I feel good." I said, "All right, you ready to go on the big kid hill?" She said, "Yeah." And she's like 12 at the time, maybe. And like I got to, you know, just hold her hand and like help her snowboard down the big kid hill. And it was amazing. I mean, it was just amazing. And on the ride home, she said, Will, this is like the best Christmas gift I've ever gotten. And she's like, you know, my mom says you're a lot like my older brother was, but he committed suicide when he was 21, and he had a little drug problem, so I'm sure the two were related, but that's not for me to decide. She said, so you're kind of like the big brother I never had. I said, Megan, I'm actually the big brother you do have. And there's one thing I could tell you is I'm not going anywhere. Like, I'm not going to go anywhere. Like, that's what CA gives me. Like, I can tell my family with the utmost assurance that I'm not going anywhere. You know, I was asked if I want to quit for good. You know, I live life a day at a time, man, but like, I'm here. I'm here to stay. Like, why wouldn't I be? Life is so damn good. You know, and like, I'm really looking forward to having these same experiences with my daughter now. You know, I already got her a backpack that can carry her, a tandem kayak, a little camping chair. I'm ready, man. She's starting to hold her head up, so we're getting close. I mean, that's what it is. Yes, I mean, I have a newer car than I ever had, and I have a home that I never owned, and I make more money this year than I've ever made any other year, and it just keeps getting better. Sure, like, when I stop shooting speedballs and have a full-time job, it's inevitable that I'm going to get nice things. It's inevitable. But that stuff has come and gone, and what really can't be replaced or put a price tag on is the love and the connections and relationships that I have in my life today. I would not trade them for the world, and they give them away free right here in the rooms of CA. Given away free, man. Just, it's all right there for the taking. You know, and I mean, there's not much more I could say. I mean, what CA gave me and what I hope I did for you tonight was offer you a message of hope, a promise of freedom, and the absolute guarantee that you never have to feel the way you did when you got here. That's all I got.
All right, thank you so much. That was awesome. Let's circle it up and pray. Thank you.